This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any breaking episodes and news on the cases that we are following. Today, we're going to be talking about Brian Koberger. We're going to talk about DNA and specifically one of the pieces of evidence that has been brought up to be a very, is viewed thus far publicly, solid pieces of evidence. It's a piece that connected him to his parents. It's a piece that was in the probable cause affidavit. But how strong is that piece alone when put together with the other pieces of evidence that we have certainly seen? It stands up. But by itself, the knife sheath, the button on the knife sheath specifically, where they found some of Koberger's DNA, does that stand up as a strong piece of evidence putting him at a crime scene, considering DNA does not have a time stamp on it? With that, we're joined by forensic scientist and professor Dan Crane to discuss. Dan, thoughts on that?
Well, I think you've already summed it up pretty nicely in in saying that what I find myself telling attorneys all the time is the presence of a DNA profile doesn't tell us anything about how or when that DNA came to be associated with what you've been testing. And so in this case, with the knife sheath, you know, we also need to bear in mind that this is a movable object, right? It's something that could have been picked up by somebody else and left at the scene of the crime. It could have been left there as the crime was being committed, right? So the DNA tests themselves are completely silent on that sort of thing. All they say is whose DNA is there. They don't tell us anything about how or when it came to be there. So, of course, the prosecution is going to argue the how and the when is because it got left there during the commission of a crime, a horrible quadruple homicide. But the defense will have the opportunity to argue that, well, you know, the defendant discarded that knife, you know, years ago, or somebody took that from him weeks ago, and he had nothing at all to do with the crime, right? So, and the DNA test results by themselves are absolutely silent in terms of which of those competing hypotheses might be more likely.
Is there any technology here? Because with all the things that DNA can tell us, and this is not even specifically to this case, but that seems to be almost the one identifiable marker that DNA does not have for us yet, and that is time, as long as it's been there. Those are key things that really would be able to help when DNA is found at a crime scene. Is there any technology, is there anything that you foresee ever being able to be done to give an age, give a timestamp as to when this DNA marker, whether it be touch DNA, whether it be blood, whatever it is, of when it was actually put at the scene of or whatever object we're talking about?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. If anything, I think we're backsliding. We're getting less insights in terms of time than we would have had in the past. You know, in the early days of DNA profiling, back in the early 90s, for instance, the test kits required quantities of DNA that it was very difficult to transfer by an innocent means, by touching or sneezing even. And so those larger quantities of DNA that the earlier test kits required actually made this less of an issue, because it was hard to explain how you could have gotten a blood stain the size of a quarter innocently transferred or deposited, you know, by some innocent means. But as the test kits have become so much more sensitive, these problems associated with what are said to be persistence and transfer of DNA have just become increasingly problematic. it's conceivable from a theoretical basis that in another 5-10 years, we may have some additional tests that would give some insight in terms of the age of the sample. Those might not be based on DNA. They might be based on proteins that are coming along with the DNA. But there's going to be a lot of admissibility challenges to that sort of testing, and there's nothing like it that's available today.
Obviously interesting, because 20, 30 years ago, that we would have said the same thing about what we have now. So yes. To say, you know, what's down the road, I guess that's anybody's guess. It's always interesting to understand how that technology continues to evolve. DNA, obviously, nice to have, but not necessarily putting him at the scene. And the connection then to where they traced him down at his parents was based on that testing of that knife sheath with that 99.99888 or something percent probability that the parent of whoever touched this knife sheath are these people here in Pennsylvania. Again, it doesn't connect anyone necessarily to a murder. It just says that the DNA on this knife sheath, these are likely the parents, almost beyond a reasonable doubt. With genetic DNA testing and the way that it's going, and not necessarily speaking specifically in this case alone, but with all the people that are putting out their DNA for genetic DNA testing to learn their lineage and such, how do you see the future going as far as finding more killers or finding more people who have been at fault at a crime coming about with all that information becoming available?
Well, there's no doubt that that increasing availability of DNA test results is going to be a very powerful tool for law enforcement. As long as 5 years ago, there were estimates that more than 90% of the North American population had at least two cousins whose DNA had been entered into one of those genealogy databases. Mm-hmm. Two cousins is plenty enough to do the triangulation that's needed to be able to identify somebody who is not in the database as having been the source of some material. So to a large extent, we're all under genetic surveillance these days, whether we've chosen to be or not. And I know there are some interesting civil liberties considerations here, right? Questions about informed consent. Did the people who were submitting their DNA to see if they had a missing, you know, half sibling somewhere, or a cousin or an uncle that they wanted to reconnect with, did they realize that they were potentially casting a shadow of suspicion on a family member they might not even know? So again, there's some interesting issues in play there, but the short answer to your question is that it is certainly going to be something we hear about more and more. And, I think it's also interesting that North America seems to be particularly obsessed with this type of genealogical testing. It is much less an issue in Europe, and it is virtually unheard of in Asia. But in North America, for whatever reason, we have the interest and the disposable income such that people are stepping up to add their DNA to these databases. And again, it's whether it's intentional or not, they're creating a very powerful tool for law enforcement.
When we're talking about DNA, obviously, that seems to be the sexy term to talk about when it comes to any sort of crime case. But there's far more things that are examined forensically than just DNA at a crime scene. Can you speak to that a little bit more and give us a better idea on what other sort of things they're going to be looking for based on the evidence that was collected in the Koberger crime scene beyond just DNA?
Well, you know, let me start with the DNA, because I think everyone will agree, even practitioners of other aspects of forensic science, that DNA really is the gold standard of forensic science. And that's been fair to say for at least 20 years now. Mm-hmm. It became the gold standard, and it is the gold standard because it established a very robust means of attaching statistical weights to the finding of, and I'm going to use air quotes here, a match between an evidence sample and a suspect. Other forensic disciplines for many decades had not even attempted to attach a statistic. They would say things like, well, this is these two fingerprints are you know, from a single person, and they're unique, without ever having actually tested to see if fingerprints were actually unique. But now, you know, there are serious efforts that are underway to attach numbers to the how impressed you should be that two fingerprints match. And there are statistics that are being developed to talk about handwriting comparison and hair and fiber comparison. And, you know, the list goes on and on. For a case like the quadruple homicide in Idaho, you should expect that there will be, you know, they'll bring every forensic technique to bear that they can, and that's going to be a long list. There's going to be things like blood spatter analysis that could be evaluated, even if they don't find blood on the defendant or any of his possessions. They can still use blood spatter to gain some insights in terms of the order in which individuals were killed, the position of the attacker, even some insights in terms of the stature of the attacker, you know, their height, mm-hmm. for instance. So blood spatter is likely to be involved. Certainly there will be attempts at fingerprinting. Certainly there will be attempts to determine if there may be some stray fibers, a carpet fiber, for instance, that might, you know, connect the defendant to the crime scene. A hair sample, of course, would be something that they'd be interested in as well. And that could be an animal hair as well as a human hair. And I understand that there is talk of a dog's hair potentially playing a role in that particular case. So, you know, the list goes on and on. And, you know, we shouldn't forget about the types of computer analyses that have been done as part of the investigation as well. Those are forensic tests as well.
How easy, or maybe not easy is the applicable term, for someone to go in and commit a crime like this and not leave some sort of signature behind, whether it's DNA, fibers? Is it almost a guarantee that you're going to be taking some with you and leaving some there, whether you're extremely careful or not?
Well, that is one of the foundational principles of forensics going back over 100 years, is that every contact leaves a trace. And just as you say, both the perpetrator would leave some of their material at the crime scene, but they would also take some of the crime scene away with them. And both of those are things that could be used as part of a investigation. But again, we're living at a time now where the DNA tests in particular are so very sensitive that it becomes a double-edged sword. And once again, there are these questions, concerns about persistence and transfer. You know, the tests are so sensitive that they could be picking up DNA that was left behind at a crime scene a decade before the crime had occurred. So again, it can make the interpretation very open to alternatives.
I mean, for example, would this be a example of one of those interpretations? Koberger's in a knife store. He's taking a look at a knife sheath. He unbuttons it, puts it back, doesn't actually buy it. It's still at the store. Other people look at it. Somebody else buys it. It's been cleaned up pretty well. You know, the store washes it down or whatever. And then somebody else buys it. Let's say the murderer, for playing devil's advocate, that Koberger is not the murderer, but Koberger's DNA is on the knife sheath itself. Could that be the connection that was made there? Again, saying that that would be the only piece of evidence, if that's what they would be arguing. But that could be an example of how you could place the wrong person at a crime scene if you only have limited evidence.
I agree. And I think at some point you just have to start saying, well, how plausible would this kind of alternative be to a jury? But at the end of the day, a DNA expert would tell you that there's nothing about the DNA test results themselves that would tell you which of two alternatives were more likely.
Sure.
The scenario you described or the scenario that the prosecution would probably want jurors to contemplate, and that is that the defendant's DNA is on that button of the knife sheath because he unfastened the button just prior to committing a gruesome quadruple homicide.
And the other pieces of evidence being the other things that would back it up. Like one, if that was the only thing you had, one could make the argument that, well, maybe someone touched this at the store or you touched it at the store. But when you have and the evidence over here and the cell phone pinging and all of that, that is what ends up making the case together to go, well, yes, it could have technically been on that one piece, but all this together collectively shows us that you, beyond a reasonable doubt, were likely there.
Right. Yeah. You know, it brings to mind a great attorney that I worked with about 15 years ago said to me, hey, look, Dan, here's the thing. I'm weaving together a symphony to entertain the jury with. I need you to deliver one note. I need you to be crystal clear and easy to understand. And I'm going to point to you and I'm going to call out that one note. But it's just one note in a symphony, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's essentially the way a prosecutor or a defense attorney needs to look at a complicated crime scene like the one that we're talking about in Moscow, Idaho.
Dan Crane, forensic scientist and professor at Wright State University, thank you for joining us and giving us your insight on today's story. That's going to wrap up this episode of the program. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any breaking updates, discussions on the stories that we're covering for you here at Hidden Killers. You can follow me on Twitter at Tony B Pod for my commentary off the air as well. I'm Tony Bruschi. Until next time, for all of us, thanks for listening.